I think I'll begin. I think there may be a few more people coming, but I know the time is somewhat limited. My name is Peter Christensen. I'm a PhD candidate at Harvard University, and before I begin this presentation, I would like to quickly just give you some background as to how this came to pass. Harvard holds the archives of Peter and Allison Smithson, who are relatively well-known figures in the modern canon, and I was doing research in the archives and came across a series of projects that they had designed but never realized in what we may call the Islamic world. Now, they actually designed a lot of projects that were never realized, and this is just a selection of them, and I've lumped them together under this larger theme of their projects in the Islamic world, and that may or may not sort of cohere them, but we can get to that when this is done and after I've made my presentation. All right. The lives of Peter and Allison Smithson were always intrinsic to and reflected within their professional output. Upon meeting at Durham University in 1948, Allison Gill and Peter Smithson would become both lifelong business partners as well as husband and wife. Eccentric interests like Allison's passion for Christmas cards and children's books and Peter's passion for road trips all found their way in some form or another into their teaching, writing, and design. One less recognized channel of interest I hope to reveal today was a keen fascination in the Islamic world. It is only through a string of unbuilt projects that we may begin to explore how this interest in Islamic urban and architectural form interloped and intermingled with more familiar notions of modernism in the latter half of the 20th century. Although the lack of scholarship on this facet of their oeuvre can be explained away by many things, Eurocentrism, the relative obscurity of their presence in the Smithsons' archives, or the simple fact that they were never built, this presentation is not meant to operate as a corrective of any kind. On the contrary, it will explore its obscurity and its richness as a standalone problematic that can subsequently be handled in any number of ways. The issues I wish to explore are more of a historical nature than a biographical one. How might we consider the Smithsons' projects for the Islamic world within the context of the growing consciousness of the pitfalls of the West's creative involvement with the East, in a 30-year span, punctuated at midpoint, if only as a cultural referent, to the publication of Edward Said's Orientalism in 1978? And how might we, in turn, more specifically, consider the characterization of suitable Islamic urban and architectural form set forth by the Smithsons as progressive to or reflective upon both prior and future models of Western interventions in the Middle East and Africa, if at all? The Smithsons married in 1949 and established their own firm in 1950. In 1951, they paid their first visit to Islamic lands, driving eastwards through Paris to Istanbul via the Balkans. Written accounts of this trip record notes of mosques along the way, including ones in Budapest, the town of Yace, and Sarajevo. But it appears to be in Istanbul that their interest in the material culture of the Islamic world manifested itself as a discrete line of inquiry. In a 1988 article for Architecture USSR, Peter wrote of the time in Istanbul as the one where him and Allison became observers of the Islamic functional tradition and its quite other ordering of architecture and urbanism compared to the Western tradition of classical ordering. 2 years later, they submitted a proposal for a competition for a hospital in the capital city of then British Mandate, Qatar, in the capital city of Doha. Peter recalls visiting Doha in 1953, observing it to be a poor city-state on the Persian Gulf, whose indigenous stock of buildings was one- or two-story flat-roofed earth dwellings. He goes on to recall how Doha's urban form lacked any evidence of ordering, the type of which he seems to have imagined would exist elsewhere in Islamic architectural or urban thought, going on to note that it was only subsequently in three highly developed studies for Kuwait City, 15 years later, that they had responded to a concept that he would identify as the mat fabric of place. The Smithsons emphasize an equally intriguing and ambiguous set of terms that frame the way in which their own inheritance of a functional tradition in Islamic architecture and urbanism was mediated and performed, presumably distinct by virtue of their own experience as Northern Europeans. He notes, quote, "Our way forward has always been one of observing, then making the inventive jump, then looking to see what we have got. In retrospect, relating our observations to our inventive jump in order to explain to others its depth of connection, cross-references, and meaning. The observing for us is the gaining of confidence and energy for the jump. Between looking and doing, there is a large irrational gap. This is why we speak of jump, because there is otherwise no way of explaining the connection between things consciously and unconsciously observed, and the form giving that extends the language of architecture and urbanism. Certainly, the proverbial jump from the field to the drawing board is not procedurally unique to designing in an Islamic context. However, deploying it as a qualifier for their inheritance of Islamic design seems oddly dependent upon the two rather personal qualities of affording themselves sufficient interpretive confidence and for these subsequent interpretations to make sense to others. Others presumably signifying their Western counterparts. More explicit than such cultural transliterations was the frank confession that because they were Northern European inheritors, they could not react intuitively to a bright light climate. Indeed, it was the projects for Kuwait that cemented a great number of the ideals of the Smithsons' approach to Islamic form. But before jumping this far ahead in time, I wish to ask for your forgiveness and that I will break one of my own rules I've set forth for myself in this presentation, showing you projects exclusively from the Islamic world, including Kuwait, Khartoum, Tehran, and Alexandria, because I have also included a work of industrial design, the Trundling Turk Chair of 1952, and an architectural project in London, their headquarters for Iraqi Airways. I also must add that in addition to not discussing the Doha Hospital project in depth, I will also admit the projects of which yet less documentation exists, including their Solar Pyramid of Giza of 1976, the Damascus Gate of 1979, and the Gul Baba Mosque in Budapest of 1987. The Trundling Turk Chair, created in 1956 for the exhibition This Is Tomorrow at the Whitechapel Gallery in London, not to be confused with their House of the Future exhibition of the same year, is seen here. This is the cover of their brochure. For their part, the Smithsons designed an all-plastic, speculative, and futuristic dwelling in the House of the Future exhibition. But this chair was held in suspension from that exhibition in a separate show of their industrial design and arrives just a few years after their eponymous visit to Turkey. There is, in fact, no record that the chair had anything Turkish to it, looking actually much more akin to the Destieldines of Rietveld and Mondrian than to the kilims or woven fabrics whose praise they sung in their writings from Istanbul. The chair, by the standards of 1956, is unusually historicist and anything but futuristic, the themes that they were working on at the time. Was this perhaps a Turkish future, or merely an arbitrary and catchy alliteration? This rendering depicts a seated woman in the chair in what appears to be a mural-sized blow-up of a sketch produced by Le Corbusier during his travels to Algeria. A similar mural also appears in Eileen Gray's E1027 house, and this is a sort of series of connections that I'd like to investigate in more depth in the future. 4 years later, while hard at work on the most well-known of all Smithson's projects, the Economist Building, the small sales office for Iraqi Airlines at 188 Piccadilly proved a stunning counterpoint to the ethos of the Smithson's new brutalism, or lack of refinement of raw materials, that the Economist Building came to typify. Sandwiched between a grocer and the sales office for Pan Am, the office occupied a renovated Edwardian storefront just 14 feet in width. In the documentation of the project, the Smithsons get particularly involved with what we might call today brand consulting, noting that the airline found its status along JAL, El Al, and Icelandic Airlines, exotics that could excel at being themselves, since by being, comparatively speaking, small, they could not compete or conquer the mass market. In considering the nature of airlines' ticket offices, the Smithsons, as always, conducted extensive photographic research of precedents. Here, one can see the distinctive differences already at play between the electrified nature of airlines such as Pan American and the boutique nature of airlines like Pakistan International on the bottom, both airlines on the same block as that of the Iraqi one. To distinguish itself, Iraqi Airways had to focus on image, with Allison noting that that of Iraqi Airways, quote, must therefore be built on more personal attention, service suited to the individuality of taste, exquisite tickets, and such beautiful, mysterious, or bizarre hostesses as the country of origin can supply, end quote. To cite an example, she recalls a flight to Greece on Olympic Airlines where a hostess played traditional Greek tunes on a mouth organ all the way. Ethnic stereotypes and ethnographic motifs were, the Smithsons seem to be suggesting, all that backwater nations had in a competitive capitalist tourist industry. A commodification of ethnicity ensues, with national identity being likened to a financial variable, with Allison going on to argue that by such nature, airlines express their nationality, as it is their greatest asset. Contemporary sensibilities might judge the line of political correctness to have been crossed with a marketing vitrine, depressed at street level at the building's frontage, depicting an Iraqi man standing in sand and holding a falcon. For the Smithsons, the depiction of falconry, a sport originating from ancient Mesopotamia, merited particular interest because of its time-trodden geopolitical history between European and Middle Eastern courts. Despite the facile stereotype, Allison makes it clear that this cross-cultural encounter on Piccadilly is something of a two-way street, when she notes how it had often been said in British society that the British find a hole in the ground irresistible, as it has to be looked down upon. This view from above was lionized when Shop and Showroom Review magazine chose the display for their cover in 1962. The interior is considerably less jarring. Described as a sand-colored tunnel, clean as the desert, the narrow width of the shop is broken up by undulating tiled counters, recessed lighting, tactile fabrics, and inset plaster casts of antique Mesopotamian reliefs, courtesy of the British Museum. The larger of the two casts redoubles the falcon motif on both the front and back of the shop. The more formative projects in Kuwait began in 1968, 6 years after the completion of Iraqi Airways. It was here that the Smithsons' conception of the matte fabric of Islamic architecture and urbanism fully reveal itself. For the Smithsons, the term matte came from the English calling the traditional small carpet from Central Asia a mat, although Le Corbusier had used the same term to describe his design for the Venice Hospital in 1964. It is important to keep in mind that their delineation of the term is post facto, and the origins of it seem to be very much a subtext of contradistinctions between Le Corbusier and the Smithsons that began with the Smithsons' rejection of SIAM, the Congrès International d'Architecture Moderne, and the formation of Team 10. Regardless, unlike the Venice Hospital, the Smithsons tie the notion of matte building directly to the Islamic context and not to general architectural principles unhinged from cultural specificity. It is important to note the lively debate Siam engaged in later years, particularly concerning the French protectorate of Morocco, which was discussed extensively in their meeting in Aix-en-Provence, in which the Smithsons participated. So their interaction with debates about Middle Eastern urbanism had begun a little bit before they came to Kuwait in 1968. That year, the Kuwaiti government invited them to propose an urban form study for the old city of Kuwait. In an attempt to articulate the alternative ordering of Islamic cities that could impart the type of urbanism that would have been encountered by caravan traders for centuries, the Smithsons turned first to architectural historian K.A.C. Creswell, author of the seminal Early Muslim Architecture of 1932 and Muslim Architecture of Egypt of 1952. Both publications appear in the Smithsons' notes, as do traced copies of numerous mosque plans from either publication. It was the Deir al-Bari that emerged to Peter and Allison as the first mat building of the Islamic world. It was here that the beginnings of an even laying down, their words, that was to become common to all Islamic buildings, whatever their stylistic or period inheritance, first appears. In their writing of the project, Peter and Allison further ruminate on the influences of their first eastward journey, postulating that the foregrounding of the mat concept must have also had origins in the literally layered mats carpeting the floors of the mosques they visited in Yugoslavia, most notably a small roadside mosque that they both remember with great fondness halfway between Jajce and Sarajevo. It was here that they claimed to see both Austro-Hungarian Baroque influence and the alternative ordering that was Islamic by virtue of, one, light from low-level sources spreading across the mat-covered floor, two, an uncluttered space whose mat-covered floor was given as a whole surface to the worshippers, and three, a space functional to those who pray using only the luxury of a mat. The Smithsons returned to Egypt for inspiration on the formulation of the mosque as typology, finding inspiration of the mosque of Amir ibn al-As. Noting its incredible transparency and light touch, they juxtaposed the mosque with the marabout of Kayserine, Tunisia, noting how solid, volumetric construction is often also appropriate in successfully fashioning a cool interior microclimate amidst oppressive exterior heat. Yet in the even-handed laying down of the mat typology had nothing to do with solid or light construction necessarily, but more to do with equitable, repetitive ordering that they also found here in the cemetery of Monastir in Tunisia. Such repetition was found also in a vertical arrangement, as was evident in the Gorfas of North Africa. Because the proverbial mat, like all human-made things, was imperfect, the weave of the mat was prone to crevices, which in fact held in them a purpose in their protection against the direct rays of the sun, exemplified nowhere better than in the Kasbah of Algiers. The crevices in the fabric are lit by reflected light and make up a capillary network of shared routes that induce air movement. The idea of a shaded, cool route is held in contrast to an open landscape in the full glare of daylight. The crevice, the Smithsons would claim, could be seen to be under surveillance, a concept reminiscent of Jane Jacobs' idea of defensible space, outlined 7 years earlier in the seminal Life and Death of Great American Cities. Most poetically, the Smithsons liken the end of the crevice route, or the fringe of the carpet, if you will, to the minaret of Ibn Tulun in Cairo. Here, the fabric of the mat wound itself upwards into the air towards the heavens. Save the Yugoslav mosque, all of the other inspirations of inheritance came to them through the prism of architectural historian Creswell. Here, the aforementioned jump is gauged through once-removed observations, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but a framework of knowledge worth bearing in mind. That is also not to say that their research in Kuwait was anything short of formidable. Much of the conclusions they derive from their examples can be seen to be echoed to varying degrees in their own documentation of Kuwait's old city center. You see here both permanent and temporary residents that they were settlements that they were documenting. Moreover, the notion of the fabric, with its crevices and holes, horizontal and vertical articulations, functions as an operative tool for the analysis of the site. Sketches reveal the primacy of the nodal points and crevices, and solid versus light construction as analytical entities. The result of the urban form study, as research project, was a relatively under-distinguished matting of a large swath of Kuwait's old city fabric. Nonetheless, the final report is characterized by a series of both practical and polemical statements about what a new Kuwait should look like. On the practical side, the Smithsons had identified minarets as markers of the mat fabric, a means of wayfinding in the otherwise undifferentiated mat fabric of the city, where shaded pedestrian flows were to remain undifferentiated and omnidirectional. They also emphasized the city's coastal condition, noting how the city should maintain a low profile, literally and figuratively, maintaining a horizontal quality that retains the natural relationship to the water. On the more polemical side were conclusions that Kuwait need be a city which rejects overt expression of the individual struggle for power and money characteristic of North American cities, and which, quote, keeps to the patrician tradition of the subdued public face, for status and wealth being understood within a close-knit society do not need to be advertised or proven in any way, end quote. Approving of their research and general scheme, the Kuwaiti government further sponsored the Smithsons to develop a demonstration building that would articulate the governmental swath of the fabric. The objective herein was to architecturalize the urban scheme and bring its comprehension down to the level of the occupant. While clearly at play here more than any previous project by the Smithsons, the matte characteristic of the Kuwait demonstration building is still one that emerges belatedly in their writings about a decade later. So they don't describe this as matte until the 70s, well after Le Corbusier had used it to describe the Venice Hospital. Here we see one of the design portions for the ministerial district of the new city with its large central courtyard. Consisting entirely of rough-hewn concrete, office space and garages are hoisted upwards by a columnar field which opens up a massive amount of unprogrammed and shaded space for free-form interaction at ground level. Moreover, the strategy of the crevice, as cited in Algiers, can here be seen as a strict visual device guiding sightlines to the minarets of the mosques, while also providing a proper place for the inclusion of the traditional wadi, or the shallow pool of water running at ground level that you see here, cooling off the temperature of that which surrounds it. In certain instances, these crevices are embedded with planters, which allows for the growth of trees and other indigenous vegetation. One interesting juxtaposition in the Smithsons' note is a comparison between the Galleria of Joseph Paxton's Crystal Palace, where it was found within a field, and with those of the Kuwaiti proposal used as a fixed space of self-identification, as if to suggest the interchangeability of the galleria, or crevice, with European and Islamic models. In the European context, the galleria offers the inhabitant the expanse of the architectural vista transparently, while in the Islamic model, the crevice operates as the defensible space in which to circulate outside of the architectural vista. Whether this distinction is a product of climate or culture is not entirely clear, yet it is all the more provocative to problematize this historical layering of such a comparison by recalling that it was actually Paxton who relied on the color scheme set forth by Owen Jones, the architect, in his research on Mudéjar architecture in Spain to employ color as a wayfinding system for the Crystal Palace. So the Islamic and Christian references are falling one on top of the other here. Interspersed throughout the matte fabric are a series of obelisk-like vertical elements demarcating the nodal locations of both parking and cooling utility stations. Piercing the horizon line at a height just shy of the minarets, these elements function as the most definitive visual marker of the ministerial district and its civic function. There is, embedded within this gesture, something of a criticality about the non-hierarchical and spontaneous nature of much Islamic urbanism. The Smithsons state, quote, "Arab cities are full of buildings started and never finished, and finished and then abandoned, for it would seem the Arabs are more spontaneous, less worldly than the East or West," end quote. Such spontaneity is, however, not to be hampered by their design. While the stasis of the ground level's unprogrammed ambiguity adds distinctive qualities to the type of urbanism being introduced, the matte fabric above is nothing more than a matrix of cellular structures whose function could oscillate easily from bakery to barbershop, fabric store to restaurant. It is but only the governmental district that needs a certain level of specificity, a clearly articulated permanence afforded by the vertical wayfinding system. Such ambiguity is most evident in the renderings of the interior spaces, be it an office space whose only forms of specificity come from Persian rugs, planters, and non-load-bearing spatial dividers, or utterly indistinct industrial spaces. The new roads introduced by the scheme are to be employed to clearly delimit different districts and their functions, as one can see most clearly from that of the ministerial district. Massive parking garages are coupled with transportation hubs for public buses and shared taxis at the district's threshold. You see here one of the structures. Much of the balance of the proposal involves the normative practices of urban master planning, with the notable exception of two maidans, or open spaces, for particular cultural and civic functions. The first, dubbed the Orangerie Maidan, is a space inspired by the orangeries of Versailles and Potsdam, seen here. Planters containing citrus trees could provide spaces for fragrant nighttime walks, or, when removed, spaces suitable for light exhibitions or spectator stands that Kuwaiti civic and religious festivals require. Here we see two collaged examples depicting the Maidan, which are inhabited by 13th century Mamluk figures on horseback. So this is rather anachronistic. The sports Maidan, located adjacently, would function as a more public space for the whole Kuwaiti populace to engage in sports, which, in their rendering of the space, depicts equestrian sports yet again in an undeniably Orientalist mode. In conjunction with the Kuwait Urban Form Studies and Demonstration Building, the Smithsons proposed a landscape scheme independent of the global planning and architectural schema entitled, quite playfully, the Kuwait Dune and Pleasure Rampart Gardens. The landward perimeter of the old city of Kuwait was a linear strip of mound set between the ring road planned by British subcontractors in 1951, seen here. The curvaceous linear garden traced the lines of earth and wall built during the Wahhabi Wars of 1919. Functioning as a greenbelt, the linear garden was primarily characterized by tiled mounds of Persian and Isnik tiles, both foreign to Kuwait, in a strict turquoise, blue, viridian, and indigo color scheme that evoked what the Smithsons described as melancholy spectacle. The Smithsons envisioned the longevity of the tiles primarily for the beauty they saw in Turkish tiles, despite nil maintenance. Considered an alternative to the corniche as a place to stroll, the garden was one from which the Smithsons drew inspiration from similar sites as diverse as those found in York, Dubrovnik, Carcassonne, and Aguas Mortes. The Smithsons returned to the Islamic world in 1977 with the Anil Avenue commercial offices for Khartoum, Sudan. The client, a private developer, urged that the construction period take as little time as possible, and the architects followed suit. They minimized their research to a handful of photographs taken of the area, perched along the Nile and abutting the commercial heart of Khartoum. A series of black and white photographs illustrate the banal nature of the leafy streets of the city's nicest quarter, while a series of color photographs of the souk testify to a livelier, more interesting form of everyday urban economy. In terms of history, the Smithsons note little of interest beyond the Turco-Egyptian rule of Sudan until 1821, the installation of a Union Jack plan by the British in 1898, and the building of a quote, suitable hotel in 1902. And their design would not in all actuality change that due to the extreme limitations in budget and schedule set forth by the client. What does become evident is how the Smithsons operated under tight constraints. Aborted after just 3 months of design, the initial proposals focus on essentially two things and nothing else: sun control and the use of steel. Khartoum was to be the most challenging of all the sites in terms of the mediation of natural daylight by virtue of its proximity to the equator. These light studies show a sensitivity to the building's placement both in its site plan but also in terms of the diffusion of light to both standard and seated workers on the interior. A tufoil brisolet surrounds each level's glazing, supported in turn by an exteriorized prefabricated steel trussing system that holds both floor plates in tension and the glazing and brisolet in suspension. They also took considerable interest in the aging of the exteriorized steel structure, rendering two versions of the view of the building from the Nile, with one taking into account the copper tone of the steel that it would take given the region's susceptibility to sandstorms, and the other unrendered. The scheme is exceedingly rational and heedful, if to a fault, of the developer's demands. Little to none of the cultural contextualization evident in the other projects appears here, in one of the most far-flung of building sites. The precise opposite could be said of a project the Smithsons were designing concurrently for Tehran. The Smithson's design was one of 10 of a field of 600 chosen as finalists by a diverse and esteemed jury overseen by the Shah Pahlavi, including Charles Correa, Fumihiko Maki, Hugh Stubbins, and Giancarlo DiCarlo, among others. The program called for a tripartite and recognizably discrete triad of library and research facilities, including a general research library for scholars, a public library, and an Iranian studies center. Peter and Allison reflected upon the entries of their peers, after an exhibition of all 600 entries, noting that there was no design pursuing the Sufi spatial and constructional tradition so that, quote, Iranian architecture can continue ingested into the modern as Mies ingested Prussian classicism into modern and thus European architecture continues, end quote. The competition brief had not explicitly stated the goal of the project to be the ingestion of Persian classicism into a modernist aesthetic, which does seem to be Smithson's objective in his incantation of Mies. It would appear as though the Smithsons gained inspiration from decidedly ancient, on the one hand, and wholly contemporary sources on the other. Peter Smithson was particularly fond of the work of Monir Farmathanian, a, quote, beautiful woman, an artist, whose work was characterized by geometric inlaid mirrors on both two- and three-dimensional forms. On the other hand, the Smithsons place yet more formal emphasis on the Sufi antecedents of Persianness through the time-trodden motif of the peacock. A real peacock feather was embedded in the plastic lamination of the report, seen on the left, submitted to the jury, a motif the Smithsons say accidentally winds up informing the plan of the library. Reductive as it may be, the motif certainly informs the strictly linear circulation between the three programs of the facility, with a wide central corridor akin to the stem of the feather, connecting tight linear wings for the various library programs. Yet the motif, I would like to argue, manifests itself in section as well, as is evident in the stemming articulation of the building's fenestration, which you see here on the left. And this is a site plan. I'm going to skip ahead for a minute. Another motif employed are the majestic Tokol Mountains, seen in the background on the image on the right here. I'm sorry if it's a little bleached out. In the foreground, in the architecture, in what the Smithsons describe as a series of soft domes, each drifting one into the other and then into the Tokol Mountains beyond, as if to create a continuous topos from the cultural treasures of Persia to the natural ones in the hinterland. It is within a set of colored renderings produced after the competition that we may begin to see where Farmathanian's influence quite literally comes to the surface. In these wildly polychromatic renderings, the simple, quote, soft domes seen in the competition proposal are amended with a set of reflective solar-powered shields placed on top, which move mechanically in unison with the daily transit of the sun, so as to protect the space beneath the glass domes from too much light and heat. Simultaneously, these operable elements would have the capacity to bring ambient light into the dome. The shields, according to the Smithsons, would be immensely popular, for they seemed both space-age and, quote, as ageless as the hand over the eyes or the rearranging of one's headcloth, end quote. The Smithsons confessed that the coloring of the renderings after losing the competition had a jarring effect, even within the office, noting that the coloring emphasized the building's unsought 19th-century feeling. They state, quote, one is timid about coloring as one is about domes, end quote. I am assuming here that it was the exuberant color scheme that not only cast doubt on the appropriateness of hypercoloration as derivative of the peacock motif, but, more interestingly, the more platonic motifs of domes as automatic and readily Islamic symbols, particularly outside the realm of the mosque. This is followed by a cryptic, intriguing comment about the use of the dome. They note, quote, now domes with funny glass sheds or bits of board or rag over their eyes are common enough throughout Islam, but in our Western world, the power, the fixity of the pantheon's geometry is terrifying, noting here the open top of the dome of the pantheon. Our domes are intended to be unfixed from the pantheon's image by a solar shield devices and by the lack of emphasis of their seating, end quote. They certainly unseat the Greco-European motif here, going one step further, almost in a sort of gleeful and sarcastic sense of defeat, to ultimately reject that it was a series of domes they were after in the first place, noting that they actually saw the design as a veined puff pastry, the bottom layers held level by the weight of those above, the top layers swelling up into soft air blebs of various sizes. And those are their words. At the risk of zooming out to more global matters, we may want to consider for a moment that the Smithson's description, sort of comic description of this architectural puff pastry, was coinciding precisely with the weightier issue that was the paradigm shift of the Iranian Revolution. In many ways, the palpable sense of rejection felt by the Smithsons on the Pahlavi project, the aging of both them and their practice, and a late arriving self-consciousness over extracultural work, all seem to speak to a last gasp of forthright, albeit naive, cross-cultural ambitions on the eve of political Islam. Any trepidation, however, would most definitely be put on the back burner for the highly prestigious competition for the Alexandria Library 10 years on. One of the most prominent commissions in the Islamic world in recent memory, the Alexandria Library emerged as a competition co-sponsored by the Egyptian government and UNESCO in 1987 to reinstate the famed Alexandria Library of Antiquity, seen here in a map by Ottoman geographer Piri Reis, as a major center of learning in the modern Eastern Mediterranean. The Smithson scheme, one of their very last as an architectural partnership, was one of nearly 1,600 and did not make it to the second round, so it didn't develop very much. Although the designs remain relatively schematic given the short charrette period, one can see echoes of the concerns and strategies familiar from all of their other earlier works in the Islamic world. Much like Pahlavi, the library is divided into three distinct segments seen here in plan, including a general public library, a special section for scholars with rare books, and a division specifically for the study of Egyptian manuscripts. One can also see importance placed on sun angles, particularly given the building's housing of light-sensitive materials, as it had been diagrammed for the offices of Khartoum. The general library, the highest of the three elements raised 8 stories, would act, as in Kuwait, as a spatial marker along the Alexandria waterfront. The plan illustrates the highly compacted nature of the three programs, with interstitial circulation of the corridors in their lateral access, together acknowledging the curvature of Alexandria's harbor, a motif yet more evident in the winning scheme by the Norwegian office of Snohetta. One component of the design that appears to have been considered in great detail is the cladding of the building's southern facade, that adjacent to a vast public plaza. 3 among nearly a dozen sectional perspectives of the same portion of the building, the division between the plaza and the public reading rooms, illustrate concerns of elemental importance, lines of sight, and materiality. The leftmost drawing articulates that through the placement of the canted brisolet, or eyelid, the possibility for inhabitants on the inside to view the bodies of those in the plaza, but not vice versa, a novel take on the thinking of optical transparency within the civic and Islamic context. The middle illustration articulates the building's footing at ground level as a wadi, as opposed to a stone gutter, reflecting the hue of the Mediterranean on the undersides of the brisolet, together implying a convective cooling loop that would circulate into and out of each level's fenestration. The third illustration highlights experimentation with different types of North African stone, particularly those on the interior in deep shades of red, demarcating a distinct atmospheric change from inside to outside. As in the renderings of the Maidans of Kuwait, we find yet more Orientalist tropes, this time in the form of camels and Bedouins relaxing in the library's plaza, organized around citrus and palm trees. In the background, we encounter the facade's horizontal porosity, the strip windows, from a distance, lending it a normalized appearance that, despite the nature of the rendering's foreground, is entirely untethered to a specific sense of place. In conclusion, I would like to recast these projects at the risk of oversimplification, not as distinct projects within the architect's docket, episodic interventions in a somehow cohesive extracultural territory we may call the Islamic world, but rather as windows into an evolving and often ambiguous philosophy on what it means to be a Western architect designing in the Islamic world in the latter half of the 20th century. As an occurrence, the interloping of Western designers in the Islamic world did not become commonplace until just recently, and thus this little studied portion of the Smithsons' work offers up a provocative and useful historical template. The proverbial jump the Smithsons take as, quote, inheritors of the functionalist Islamic tradition, their words, summarily speaks to the problematics of purpose-oriented encounters that Edward Said describes in 1978. He says, quote, every pilgrim sees things his own way, but there are limits to what a pilgrimage can be for, to what form and shape it can take, to what truth it reveals. The eccentricities of Oriental life, with its odd calendars, its exotic spatial configurations, its hopelessly strange languages, were reduced considerably when they appeared a series of detailed items presented in a normative European style, end quote. Can one thus presume that the coherence and truth of Islamic urban and architectural form, as set forth by the prism of Peter and Alison Smithson, is inherently imperfect as a result? On the one hand, the answer is a resounding yet non-damning yes. Sympathetic, liberal, and curious as they were, the Smithsons working within the Islamic world often and inevitably bear the burden of European moralism and reduction. On the other, the projects align a rigorous and ambitious sensitivity to place and context that is not at all at odds with their other commissions, be they in Dover or Doha. In many ways, these works can be seen to be trapped and destined for misrepresentation when considered so strictly in the context of the coming of age of political correctness. As the Smithsons were neither pilgrims nor crusaders, but rather paid professionals rendering services in a place they happened to have some cultural interest in, their work finally treads the line of the polemical and the prosaic, speaking less to any sort of singular worldview of Islam than it does to the very opportunities and limitations of architecture as a transcultural enterprise. Thank you.